Hey guys, it's Josh Eppard from Coheed and Cambria. Do you like science fiction? Do you also like rock music? Then you gotta check out the All Things Coheed podcast. Wait, if you're already listening to this, then you probably are into those things. In that case, I ask, why are you listening to this if you don't like science fiction and rock music? What the hell is wrong with you?
Hey, this is Zach from Coheed and Cambria, and you're listening to the All Things Coheed podcast. Cool. All right, enjoy.
Hi, this is Claudio from Coheed and Cambria, and you are listening to the All Things Coheed podcast. I am the unfun one of the band.
Hello, this is Emilio Lopez, colorist for Amory Wars, Good Apollo, and you're listening to the All Things Coheed podcast.
I'm John Rua, and you're listening to the All Things Coheed podcast, otherwise known as We Know What's Up podcast.
Hi. I'm Chandra Eckert Sanchez, writer of Evil Inc. comics, Comic-Con floor fancy dancer, and mother of dragonflies. You're listening to the All Things Coheed podcast. Good luck.
Have a good day.
Welcome home to another episode of the All Things Coheed podcast.
I'm Devin.
I'm Jan.
And I'm a guy named Rob.
Hee hee, ya booty.
Today is a very special day in all things Coheed Land because today is our 100th episode.
Jesus Christ. Woo. It took us 4 years. We should have had 200 episodes by now, but yeah.
This was actually one of our most requested episodes. Today we're covering Vax's 2, the plot of A Window of the Waking Mind. Oh my goodness. It's been a year, pretty much, since we got this story. And now we're finally talking about it.
And it's a hefty one. I mean, there's a lot of good stuff in here. We get a little bit of payoff. We get a lot more world building. But there's little nuggets here and there, especially if you've been, if you've been reading all of the stories of Claudio and Chandra, you're definitely going to get some nice dividends through this one. That being said, there is another voice here that is very familiar to the listeners of the All Things Coheed podcast.
I don't know about very familiar.
I think pretty familiar at this point. We name dropped you in episodes that you're not in, so
yeah.
I think that's up there. So say hi, Jan.
Hi again. How are you guys doing?
This is so good. I'm doing great because whenever we do a story episode, it's like we gotta get Jan in here, like without question, to keep us straight.
I could try, I'm only human. I take a lot of notes. I cite sources. So hopefully, that's good. But I'm only human. I still make mistakes. I still forget stuff. So sometimes I'm like, dude, did I remember that right? And I literally have to go in. Like, this just happened, but on the Reddit, somebody was like, what's your favorite little known fact? And somebody was like, oh, Josh allegedly sang backup on Blondie's CD. And I was like, no, Josh confirmed that. Here's the citation. I sent it off to
insane.
Them. So, it's like, I try.
That's so insane. I think, by the way, we are, like we said before, we are doing a lore episode. We're going to be talking about facts and things that do happen in Vax's 2. This isn't theorizing town. But what I will say is, if you haven't listened to our episode on Vax's 1, go back and listen to it, because we do not want to spoil this story, and there's some pretty major spoilers ahead. Just throwing it out there, if you haven't listened to our Afterman episodes, you might want to get caught up on those too. I'm just going to put that out there. Devin, is there anything else you want to mention?
Yeah, absolutely. So it was created by Claudio. The story and the art concept, the actual art was done by Chase Stone, but overall, this is really written by Chandra.
The two-time world champ, Chase Stone, coming back-to-back tours on Vax's 1. Vax's 2 is here. He's fucking amazing. He's one of my favorite Magic the Gathering card artists because he does card art. every time I see his art, it just blows me away. But yeah, fuck.
There are a lot of things in Vax's act too that the images that we do have are obviously incredible, but I want to know what some of these things look like aside from their very vivid description that Chandra has written. And as we did say, it was published last year with the Vax's Act 2 box set, and then later on at Comic-Con, the soft cover version. That box set version is a hardcover. And Rob, what does it come with?
Included with the box set is a certificate of authenticity that was signed by all four members of the band for everyone who pre-ordered before January. Everything after which, you'd still get the certificate of authenticity. It's just not signed. And you can still get that now to this day. I'm pretty sure that you can go online and still buy that. That aside, we also had the Quintillion Speaker Containment Unit, which is a cute little lamp that you can set on your desk. It's awesome. It's lovely. You get a CD of the album itself, Vax's 2, A Window of the Waking Mind. You get the hardcover book that we're going to be talking about today, as well as a full fold-out of the expanded album art in the form of a poster, as well as a black card that will allow you early entry. Basically, it upgrades your general admission ticket into a prize ticket.
Yes, a prize ticket, but with no prize laminate. And although it does say it expires this month, it's valid for the rest of the No World for the Waking Mind tour. So if you have it this tour and you have a GA ticket, bring it with you. Use it. Take
four. And that includes leg one and leg two, right?
Absolutely. And the overseas shows, which unfortunately were cut short starting from the Paris date. I'm not seething, but it's fine. I hope that everyone that enjoys this tour has a great time.
It's not like the refund pages are in French or anything.
And it's not like they take a month to get the refund back to you.
Holy shit.
The soft covers are available, as well as the soft covers for Vaxis 1. Get that at the merch booth. Catch up on the story. We suggest that you listen to this episode while maybe looking at some of the art, while maybe flipping through the book. This is kind of a companion. We're not reading the whole thing. It's not an audiobook. We're just really giving a plot summary for those who maybe cannot flip through hundreds of pages of sci-fi jargon or just simply have not yet picked up.
Yes, the thing about that is, you know, when it comes to abridging the story, we leave out a lot of detail. Like, there is nothing to compare to the, you know, source material, sitting down with it, the pages, you know. They're absolutely beautiful. And I'm super excited to get into this with you guys. So if there's nothing else, I think it's time.
All right, so we'll start with the prologue. So Vaxis 1, just as a quick little recap, Vaxis 1 ends with Nia and Nostrin escaping the prison planet known as the Dark Sentencer just before it implodes. The prologue itself is really short, so I'm just going to read it. Some time has passed since the Dark Sentencer's fated implosion, an event marked by the astonishing escape of a pair of old flames. The spark between them revived once more. They set a course to seek asylum beyond the gates of a rumored free world once spoken about in hopeful tones through the spiced night air of Marison, where they were young. Furanak. But green fantasies rarely aligned with the desiderium that comes with age. A faint whisper of impending change had risen with the flicker of their rekindled adoration. There would be a third. This story finds us sometime later in the turbulent aftermath of suspended dreams and uncertainty on the heels of an extraordinary and confounding arrival.
I feel like this sets the story so well. Like, number one, we get away. Like, we don't really need to know how they escaped. They're fucking badasses. It's more like, hey, here's the world that we're living in. Time has fucking passed. So assuming she immediately got pregnant, this is where we are. And assuming that the pregnancy works the same, who fucking knows, man? But yes, things are happening. The story begins on the planet of Kroshif, a desert planet used by Haas for research. Nostrand and Nia appear to be attempting to break into a research laboratory. The Cross Pharmaceutical Therapeutic Research, CBTR, facility, owned by House Dots. In this chapter, the reader is introduced to a new character, ARP-51. Their droid companion. As they make their way through the labs, they find what it is they came for. glass vials filled with mysterious liquid. And as they load up their bags, they encounter a Scolarustia trapped in a tank, a giant anthropod creature that would kill them in an instant. When the pair are caught by lab guards, Nos triggers an emergency switch, which lets the creature go in order to escape. This creates a domino effect of other creatures being released, and in the chaos, they narrowly escape through a hole made by the creature in the exterior wall. They make it back to their ship, the Rixen Freckle. ARP 51 takes the mysterious vials for testing. We're introduced to Nos and Nia's son, Vaxus. The boy is described as motionless, yet his eyes are open and watching ahead of him.
So I guess you could describe Vaxus at this point in the story as comatose.
I'm out.
And if you're interested in seeing the Scolarustia in action, you can actually see this creature in the Liars Club music video. It actually kind of plays out the entire sequence of events, which is really cool.
I really do think that it's interesting how the, like, we are thrown into action immediately. Chapter one, we see the badassery of these two in a way that I don't feel like we saw in Vaxus 1. Like, it was a lot of, like, flashback was probably the most action we got to see. But it's very cool to see them, those two working together and being the badasses that they are.
You know, all of Vaxus 1, they pretty much were, like, apart, right? Like, one of them was presumed dead. So it's really interesting because obviously, you know, Nostrin has these like memories of doing things with Nia. And when they actually get together, it's really great to see their dynamic and see why they worked so well as a team. Like, we got a little bit of that in like the, I guess, the first part where they had like the flashback to the bank robbery. But this is like here in the now, you know, like it's really easy to see like exactly why they're so good together.
I think it's interesting to point out as well that looking at them as characters, the only thing, like we said, we saw them do is rob a bank. And now they're breaking into a facility, like a lab. You can definitely tell these characters through their time, whether it be together or apart, like they became fucking powerful. Like they're doing fucking Ocean's 11 type shit rather than just breaking open a bank. So it's pretty insane.
And immediately from the last lines, you can really tell that Vaxus is the catalyst for this change and for this development in their character. And as the story progresses, we will see that come to fruition even more. But in part two of this book, we finally get introduced to the five houses of the Star Supremacy. We're aboard the Seed, a free-floating structure built around a confined star. We learn that the houses of Star Supremacy have been alive for hundreds of years. Medicines and procedures were used to prolong life before the biopalliative suits. They only commingle with one another, and they try to lead an extraordinary class. However, new generations were built. They were incompetent, and they refused to accept their familial endowments and responsibilities. Haas believed that commoners were nothings. Currently, they are searching for the remedy to death, believing a window and a speaker together as the answer. Head Doxed makes a secret deal with Boss Candelaria to try and speed this process up. I will now read the heads of the five houses and their concepts. So we have Head on A, Reason. Biopalliative Suit has two fierce claws. We have Head Sing, known for their rage. And they're hardly a brain attached to one or two organic parts buoyed inside their regenerative bioglobe on a trio of long, spidery legs. And we have Head Doxed, probably the most predominant of the houses in this story. And he believed the key to longevity was wealth, design, and ingenuity. He has four claw-like pediapalps chosen for speed. He's crafty and high-reaching, endlessly interested in the pursuit of science, industry, business, and accumulating holdings. He does not like confrontation and is trying to find an eternally renewing energy source that would sustain the upper echelons of the five families forever without the need of dying planets or labor. Head Quar is known for risk. Does not have a single hair or patch of skin left, kind of a bit of nothing himself. And Head Tay, known for their rule, a wide face and a biopalliative suit with cryofluid just shorter than Doc's, but at his side hung a pair of enormous jagged extremities. Biceps and forearms were replaced by machinery with tritons in place of hands. Tay's limbs were stubby and decayed long ago, leaving only a little portion of torso and one partially putrefied leg dangling by failing tendons. Some pretty gnarly descriptions for these big bad guys who are really just corpses in fluid trying to survive and trying to prolong their life.
I had this idea, and I still believe it, and I don't know if it's going to be revealed later or whatever, but I feel like someone in one of the five houses, like one of the heads of houses, someone we know, I feel like somewhere deep down we'll have another Amory Wars connection here somewhere. I don't know who it'll be, but like, if you have a brain in a jar, come on, man. Like, come on. Like, it could be anybody. The designs are great. They could be literally anyone from the story, or they could be no one at all. And I think that it reminds me the most of, I don't know if you guys have seen like Hellraiser, but they remind me a lot of the Cenobites in art style and everything. It's just, it's very cool. But that aside, these are very cool villains.
I guess it's also worth noting that the logo for Haas is apparently all five of their individual sigils combined, which I thought was really cool because it really shows that obviously they have individual personalities and history, but they really are united in their goal. So I thought that was interesting too. And the seed, the headquarters, apparently all of the rings that make up their sigil also like float around, and every like so often they like meet up. It's like, dang, that's some cool supervillain thing.
And as they all try to be equal and they all have their own responsibilities, it is Head Doxed that came up with the biopalliative suits with the cryo fluid. So as much as they try to be equal, they kind of owe everything to Doxed at this point.
We're going to go and have a little flashback now. Nia and Nos, with a 2-year-old Vaxis, have come to an unnamed doctor on an unnamed planet. One in a very long line that they visited, trying to figure out why Vaxis is the way that he is. Comatose, as we said before. The doctor tries to explain what's going on, like what he's concluded after doing all of his tests, but Nia cuts him off to speak to Vaxis directly, even though Vaxis obviously doesn't respond. Maybe is asleep, we don't really know. But she explains to the doctor that both her and Nos continue to talk to Vaxis as though he was present, so that if he is aware, they don't want him to think that they're just like ignoring him or assuming what his state of being is, which I thought was really interesting. So the doctor then explains, you know, what is going on or what he knows. And he doesn't really have any answers, unfortunately. He says that all of Vaxis's vitals seem normal, even excellent in some cases. He says that even his vision, his eyes are cloudy, but even his vision seems to be perfectly fine, and he's not sure why they're cloudy at all. He confirms for them something which makes them very emotional, which is that Vaxis can feel. So when they hold his hand or they hug him, he can feel that. And Nos in particular is very emotional at hearing this. I think he's overcome with like happiness that his son can like feel. And like respond to him in some way, have that connection to him in some way. But Nia actually has an interesting counter reaction, which is she turns to look away from Nos and instead focuses on Vaxis and thinks that she's always the one that has to hold things together. So I think that's really important to note. Then the doctor gives us some bad news. Vaxis does have two abnormal readings. So the most important is that his sleeping and his waking cycles seem to be completely random or undefined. He sleeps for minutes or sometimes days and then wakes in between. And then the second issue, which is more pressing, I think, to the parents and their concerns, is that that part of his brain that indicates that he can feel, that touch response, unfortunately also seems to be in constant pain. So while he can feel, he is also registering pain all the time. And of course, you know, Nia and Nos are like, what the hell? Like, they freak out. That's really not good. Obviously, they don't want their son to be in pain, but they're not sure what's causing it. And the only solution that the doctor has is to unfortunately put Vaxis on pain medication. And the one that he suggests is one that's really common among junkies in this world. And so Nia and Nos are like, yo, we don't want our kid on like some really strong pain medication. Like, that makes them really hesitant to administer it to their 2-year-old, you know, fair point. And then of course, as the conversation between the doctor becomes unfocused, like Nia starts like tuning him out kind of as he continues to talk about what can be done. She looks down at Vaxis, and Vaxis actually opens his eyes. Then we jump back to the present. So we're aboard the Rixon Freckle again. And Nos is bringing Vaxis onto the bridge where ARP-51 is looking through those vials that they stole. We find out that the ship hadn't actually been a fighter ship, but a mapmaker's charter ship. And the couple chose that particular type of ship because it had diverse methods of navigation and piloting. And it had a large stack of maps, projections, routes, and terrains, which, of course, makes getting away from things really easy. So that's really great. They did, of course, renovate the ship. So it has a huge kitchen and a huge galley, like a living area. And then it has two staterooms, one for the couple and one for Vaxis, which I also think is really interesting because it says in the text that there's no idea in their mind of taking Vaxis out of their own room, but that they did it because they wanted this hope, this like, you know, hopefully in the future, Vaxis will have his own room. He will be, you know, more like conscious and with them and present and will want his own space. And so I think that's pretty cool. They also made him a special chair, which Nos puts him in. It swivels, it can move, it has safety restraints and hinges, because obviously if Vaxis can't move himself, he might fall out of the chair. So they have like, you know, a special chair made specifically for him. And they renovated it, so it's like super cool. It's chrome and red. And it's like any kid would like think this cool is like this chair is like super cool. So he tips him back in this chair. Nos tips Vaxis back in this chair, and he administers a vial of nutriment, which the doctor confirmed was great for him. And he almost gave him a pain patch too, but because they have these vials, he wants to wait and see what happens with that. And obviously he wants to talk to Nia about it as well, depending on what the outcome with the vials is. So he makes himself some like orange brew, which is kind of like coffee, which is pretty cool. And then he retrieves his backpack and he starts to tell Vaxis a story. He has a surprise for him. And this story is a super cool, riveting story that like any kid would be like, whoa, that's so awesome. You know, but of course Vaxis can't really relate that to him, but he tells it like he's talking to that kid anyway, right? Like Nos still speaks to Vaxis like, let me tell you about this cool, super cool story, and like just anticipates Vaxis going like, wow, cool, you know? And what he brings out is a lavender amphibian called a lout. And he explains that he used to have one of his own, which he named Kenny, and decides that Kenny 2 would be a super cool name for this one. I wouldn't give Nos any naming duties from here on out. And then he declares that, you know, he's just going to hang around him. They're not going to put him in a cage because they don't do cages, which I also thought was a really good line. So Nia comes in. She sees the lout. She teases Nos about it because she's like, really? You're going to steal the lout? Okay, what else is new? You know, they kind of tease each other about it. He offers her the coffee, but she's like, nah, I want to see about these vials, right? Like, they're just like tunnel vision. And they talk to A51 about the vials, and it's not good news. 51 gives them a really scientific output that seems really promising, but then tells him that according to like the files, 48% of the human test subjects experience cardiac failure, which means they have a heart attack and die. So obviously they're like, well, we're not going to do that. 48% is a huge percentage. So Nos actually takes the vial out of the examining dock and throws it against the wall and storms back out to put a pain patch on Vaxis. Because obviously there's no question if they have to, they're still going to continue to administer that. So the vial made the decision for them. And that's the end of chapter 3.
The world is vast and very cool. I love how they're going kind of underground and trying new things for their son. You know, like essentially it's like just anything they can try to find to make him more comfortable. And, you know, obviously their goal is to bring him back to consciousness, but they're trying to do everything else in the meantime. And that shows so much character to be like, oh, he can't react and we don't know what he's going through, but if it's showing pain, we're absolutely going to give him a patch. It says so much about their character as, you know, parents. It's wonderful. Devin, do you have anything else to say?
Yeah. And, you know, the way that they get the doctor appointment, Nia plants photos to get back at someone who made poor investments with the doctor's holdings and criminally gets this doctor's appointment. But then when they're there, they're in full parent mode. And this flashback kind of sets the stage for their assault on CBTR.
Which I believe brings us to chapter 4. So Nia begins this chapter by traversing the dangerous streets of Rayforth in search of supplies, including Vax's much needed and rare to find nutriment shots. It is here that we get an insight into Nia as she is now after her time on the Dark Sentencer. She is traumatized, but vows to keep going for Nos and her son. Here, we meet the Trafinder brothers, who know Nia from her sister Spider days. Siv and Gob were fused together, with Gob using his brother's lungs and limbs to get around. Alongside them is a spider leg droid called Ixvox 3, or Ixy for short. We get to learn about the backstory of the Trafinder brothers. Gob had once saved Nia from a falling burning engine component from a damaged cargo ship by pushing her out of the way. It fell on him, destroying his body. Siv offered up his body to save his brother, and the three go to a bar for a drink, where Nia explains her plight with her son. Gob suggests seeking out the Quintillion speakers, recounting how when moving a crate of their holding units for Candelaria of the Liars Club, Siv picked up one of those cases, and somehow Gob was able to briefly breathe on his own. He said that the cargo delivery, the windows, somehow activated the speakers. He testifies that he felt their great power and that they could possibly help their son. To achieve this, they have no choice but to head to the Liars Club.
I really liked how Rayforth is a city made on a skeleton of a extinct Goliath Zerilus, which we do not have an image of. And that's one of the things that I wish we could see. Obviously, I'm interpreting it as circular because it's planet, but it could be a very long animal and the city's just all along its spine or what have you. But Nia reflecting on her time as the Glass Widow and reflecting about dealing with Otto and killing him is a huge thing. And, you know, we didn't see the body of Otto Kruger get destroyed, but she does say that it went down with the Dark Sentencer. His gutter was obviously activated, blood came from his mouth, but she came back from a blow to the head. And we know that Haas is up to making people stay alive long after they should be dead. So I just think it was interesting that Otto got mentioned in this chapter.
So that brings us to chapter 5. We are again back on board the Rixon Freckle, and Nostrin is working out. And it's really interesting how they describe this, because it's a treadmill that's like built into the floor of the room. So it's really like spacey. and he's running on it in his boots, which I also thought was really interesting, because he says, if I'm going to go on a mission, I'm not going to wear sneakers. I'm going to wear my boots. So I might as well run in my boots, which is definitely like such a personality trait on display there. Vaxus is in the room. He's lying down on a stretching table, and his eyes are open, but he doesn't seem to be focused on looking at anything in particular. Nos does note at this point that Nia is taking a long time, but he acknowledges that sometimes when they have difficult situations like they did with the vial, she needs time away to kind of escape the really dark things and kind of breathe a little so that she doesn't crumble, but she can like process them alone and then she'll come back strong again. So that's, you know, kind of a good acknowledgement from him as well. ARP-51 does come in to stretch Vaxus. This is something that he does in order to keep his muscles from atrophying and stuff. Again, this is like showing that expectation that they do believe that one day he will be able to move on his own, and they want to set him up for that successful, you know, action rather than kind of like, you know, oh, this is just what he did, so we're just going to leave it. Like, no, they're taking a lot of steps to securing Vaxus's future. Nos decides that he's going to do the stretching instead for A51, so he kind of takes over. And Ken A2 is there as well, and he's really happy to see that these two have bonded. In a way, it seems like the amphibian really likes Vaxus, so he, like, hangs out with him really closely. He's always, like, on a body part or, like, near him. So Nos Nos starts to explain to Vax that the Lotes have a very important ability, which is they're able to camouflage themselves, but they actually don't use it. And he likens this to being a truthful and upfront person, which is why Nos himself really likes Louts. And he tells Vaxis that he came up with his codename, Creature, when a man once told him that every creature deserves to be loved by someone who would steal for it, and acknowledges that this is unconventional wisdom, like maybe not the best type of wisdom, but this is of course a line that, you know, and from the story that we did get in Vaxis 1. So that's a great callback. Nos also talks about how fair, the concept of things being fair, isn't really obtainable for most people in this world, and how he wants to change that pattern, but he won't change himself to do that. Like, he wants to make a change in the world, but this is who he is, and he doesn't want to, like, compromise his integrity, his like personal beliefs, to do that. And he feels like he can have both. And I think this is important because this is like something that he's trying to pass down to Vaxis as well. Like, hey, don't compromise yourself for like the change that you want to see. He also emphasizes in this chapter that he really just wants to make sure that Vaxis isn't suffering. Like, this is Nos's like number one fear and his number one drive for a lot of what he does, is he does not want Vaxis to be suffering in any way, shape, or form. He confesses that he never thought he'd actually be a father, especially not a good one. And he's not even sure he's a good one now, especially because Vaxis cannot really respond to his actions or his words, but he's trying. And I think that's very clear. He says that he would do anything for Vaxis, and that the world and what they might think of him be damned. He doesn't care, so long as Vaxis thinks he's a good person and a good father, that's all that matters to him. Vaxis closes his eyes again, and Nos recalls the first time that he confessed to Nia that he loved her. He actually thought that she might be sleeping, but turns out she wasn't. And how I think it's your...
You're my love, you're my life.
There we go. I knew it was love and life somewhere in there. You're my love, you're my life becomes a kind of code or a prayer between them. And of course, at this point, he tucks Vaxis into bed and Nia arrives. So that's where we end.
They're so cute together. That's all I have to say.
Vaxis is the culmination of Nia and Nos's love. And the idea that love could be murdered is a really big fear that they both have, and that is really propelling them in the story, especially at this point. So, yeah.
We then jump back to the villainous side of things. In chapter 6, we are introduced to Dr. Helix Wari, born purely of House Tay and head of the Genetic Dynamics Behavioral Molecular Research. Interesting that her name is Helix. And she's running tests to try to merge a window with a Quintillion speaker. And as the window and speaker get closer and closer, as they're naturally drawn together, the window begins to disintegrate, leaving nothing but strings of muscle and bone. And head docs, watching, commenting via projection, says for Dr. Wari to try again. So they're actively in the process. Of course, docs being relentless, and Dr. Helix Wari kind of sharing those similar characteristics, being very on top of the ball game in terms of prolonging her family's life, things aren't going so well. So it seems that the combination of a window and a speaker leads to only pain and suffering at this point in time.
It's unfortunate, I think, you know, that that they're doing this to people. Like, it's so sad. Like, to really think about it, it's just, like, imagining, like, taking sick off the streets and performing experiments, you know? It's like, come on.
What an insane parallel to Wilhelm Ryan using the stars in the star generator to get the oh, my goodness. The energy harvesting, I mean, it started with planets, and now we're working through people to try to get this energy. We move from planets in the universe to souls or people for this energy. I love this shit.
I mean, you could go one step further and then talk about the blood machine and needing bodies for that.
We haven't gotten issue 6 yet. It's coming this month. Yeah, be on the lookout for that, by the way. Next episode of All Things Coheed. I believe that brings us to Chapter 7. So, Nia arrives back on the Freckle with the Trefinders and explains the plan to return to the Cotillion, which is Candelaria's ship. Nostrand immediately shuts it down, alluding to something heinous happening within the Liars Club. We get an insight into their history with Candelaria, how the pair used to run merchandise for the club, and how Candelaria sought them out to employ them. Whatever they discovered was horrible enough for them to want to leave. Nos and Nia argue over this plan until Nos sees that Nia is only doing this as a last resort for their son. The Trefinder brothers agree to tag along after Gob confesses that he used to be in love with Nia and would still do anything for her. But he concedes to the love of Nos and Nia. And when Nos learns of the plan to get a Quintillion speaker, he completely agrees to return to the Liars Club and plots a course using the copper totem he'd kept from his Liars Club days, which grants them access. So cool. What a great chapter. We get probably my favorite character of this whole book, to be honest, up until Chapter 10, which is Gob. Gob is, like, such a stand-up dude. Like, he's not a simp, and he's, you know, he lays it all out there. He's 100% who he is all the time, and he's just sweet. He's just so fucking sweet, and he's, goddammit, he's just so deserving of love. He's my favorite.
Absolutely, Rob. I think the Unheavenly Creatures story arc is just so good at letting you know these are people who have done bad things, but they are not bad people. They have bigger hearts than maybe anyone you could ever meet. You know, the Unheavenly Creatures being more of Robin Hood figures themselves. Siv and Gob protecting those who they love. Siv even giving up his autonomy for Gob to live. It's, I mean, really, really well done in terms of character development. And when you meet actual bad guys, like the bad man himself, Candelaria, and the other houses of the Star Supremacy, these are bad people who are doing bad things.
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, going back to what Nos said in Chapter 5 about things not being fair is, like, really highlighted when you meet these two guys. Because you're like, oh, like, they're doing bad things, but it's kind of circumstantial, right? Like, they have no choice. Like, if they want to survive, especially upkeeping Gob and, like, I mean, it's like you kind of have to do some sketchy things because this world does not afford you any other option. And yeah, and then the bad guys, man, yeah, they're pretty clearly bad. Let's just put it that way.
So that brings us to Chapter 8. The Unheavenly Creatures track down the Cotillion, an iron structure akin to a flying moon, with Candelaria's face carved into the center of it all. As ships begin to enter the Cotillion, our band of heroes enter through the secondary bay on the underside of the structure, which was cloaked with a hologram. It turns out the Unheavenly Creatures never formally left the Liars Club and were able to bypass security. However, Candelaria was alerted of the return by the lounge manager, Asma, for exactly the same reason. Siv and Gob stay in the lounge as the other guests embrace the debauchery Inagra brings. As the Unheavenly Creatures wait for Candelaria, the cuff or bracelets given to inventoried attendees are magnetized and pulled the attendees to the floor. An endless series of guards come to begin the process of drawing these guests' blood. The first of many monthly draws until the attendees turn 23. Candelaria, as well as his clientele, use the plasma of youth to maintain their own energy and health. Candelaria, surrounded by Coalition watchers, makes an appearance to talk to Nostrand and Nia. They go to a private room. Candelaria takes off their mask, and Nia asks directly for a Quintillion speaker. Boss Candelaria grants them access to the seed to steal a speaker. This is in exchange for the Unheavenly Creature's delivery service to Moherio to deliver a package for Candelaria. The heroes will be accompanied by two of Candelaria's guards, who perform the transaction on this planet and make sure the cargo isn't mishandled or shaken unnecessarily in flight. The Unheavenly Creatures are wary, but begin this leg of their journey as they have no other choice.
Shit is about to go sideways, and I'm so excited to see it happen. This is, God, I just love the setup. Like, yes, it's a wonderful world, but, like, that scene of them taking the blood of all these young people is just like, wow. You really get a feel for how fucking terrible this place is after hearing about it. It's like, maybe they're not so bad. And then immediately it's like, well, we take your blood for fun. So it's fucking insane.
It's an interesting parallel to the Houses of Star Supremacies, who are trying to prolong their life through their methods. And then you have Candelaria and his clientele, who are also trying to prolong their life. Everyone's just looking for this answer for their version of the Fountain of Youth.
All right, well, buckle in, folks, because Chapter 9 is a long chapter, and I'm sure Chapter 10 is also quite long. So the Cantillion Watchers, you know, Candelaria's guards, they join them on their journey to the Seed, and Nia and Nostrin don't sleep a wink. They are on full watchdog mode, making sure that these guys do not come anywhere near Vaxis, and they even keep ARP-51 in a defense mode that will also, you know, again, double protect Vaxis. It's explained that previously in their journeys, they've stayed away from Haas radar spots to avoid having their picture taken, having their ship examined. So when they go into the Seed, they're pretty much like nobodies. Like, they don't know who they know who they're looking for, but they don't know what they actually look like. So when they arrive, they're undetected, more or less. They decide that Vaxis is going to stay in their stateroom, and once he actually gets into Seed airspace, he actually wakes up, which is pretty interesting. Vaxis, like, becomes awake, quote-unquote, and Nia tries to put him in the room. ARP-51 takes over. Ixvox is like a little lost puppy. It, I guess, loves ARP-51, follows him around. It's kind of cute. Little robot love going on there. But once they actually get to the Seed, like to the Port Authority, things really get very serious. Nia and Nox hide in a closet hallway area where they can't be scanned. And Gob and Siv actually take the helm on the ship and interact with the Port Authority. They basically decide that they're going to do that because they're a little bit more like familiar with Candelaria and with his guys, and they kind of have a little bit more of a history. So it makes more sense for them to kind of take the lead on this one than to let them do it. The Watchers, they're doing nothing. They're just chilling. They're hanging out. Just their package between them, and that's it. They are really doing absolutely nothing. When they get to the port and they're scanned, everything is cleared. The guard tells them that another's going to meet them on the platform, and quietly ends with "Liars tell no lies," which is the catchphrase that the Liars Club uses to, you know, recognize each other. So on the platform, Nia and Nos, you know, exit, and they tell the Watchers, like, hey, if we come running back, maybe lend a hand, you know? To which they're just like, whatever. You know, they're very unresponsive. They just don't care. So they get out onto the port, and a guard comes up to them and gives them armbands and tells them that this is going to kind of like materialize or kind of create a holographic Division II Haas uniform on top of their selves, which kind of allows them to blend in. But it's not a material, it's a hologram. So that's really important. They tell them which way to go and then kind of seize them off, like, you're on your own, buddies. And off they go. They wander around. They get to these checkpoints that also have to scan them, and they're not sure if it's going to pass, but they pass. Everything seems to be chill, but like a little too chill, because things are really quiet, and they're not, like, a lot of them are like, especially Nos, he's like really disconcerted with how quiet things are and says that's not normal. Like, the port was bustling, there were tons of activity, but in here there's like nothing. And everybody's like, look, maybe this is a blessing in disguise. Let's just, you know, think positively. Let's, you know, hopefully we'll get in, we get out, we're good, you know? So they go on and they find the holding room. The holding room has a bunch of windows inside, and Nia like looks in and immediately sees there's people of all different races, age. They have like nearly nothing in common, all sorts of different, you know, features. And they are restrained in specific compartments with like a 20-digit code that labels them from each other. Some are not in good shape. Some look like they're really on the verge of death. And Nia is not, like, really unsettled. She does not like this. She decides that she wants to try to save them, like to release them. But of course, they really can't. Like, they don't have the time or like the effort, like they're trying to sneak in, sneak out. So Nas says, look, if we can come and get what we did, like we'll try to save them on our way out. Nuss realizes especially that these must be Windows because they have the same uniform that Mr. Wish on the Dark Sentencer was wearing. And he wonders what Mr. Wish's connection to Haas was. So suddenly, as they're continuing on, there's a blaring announcement that a trial is about to begin and urges everybody to take cover. So they try to rush on, you know, like, oh, okay, you know, let's keep going. Screw the announcement. We don't really care. We're here to get something specific. And they do find a hatchway down a corridor, which is glowing blue. And Nia instantly is like, this is the thing. We need this. Because she's been around Quintillion speakers on the Dark Sentencer. So she knows what that light, what that energy feels like. And she knows that that's it. But as they make their way down the corridor, out of nowhere, seemingly out of nowhere, a group of guards actually makes their way and calls them out like, hey, what are you guys doing here? And they realize that they're carrying a cart with some kind of capsule on top of it. And they just try to bullshit their way through it. And it almost works, except the guard is like, nah, but you can't be here because there's like a thing going on. And they're like, yeah, but we're supposed to be here. And they're like, no, you're not. Fucking go. And when they hesitate, Siv decides that he's going to reach for his gun. He's not going to pull it, but he's going to reach for it. And when he does that, the hologram of his uniform glitches out a little. And immediately the guard notices and goes, what was that? And their gig is up. It is over. So when doing that, they take them out. Siv even tries to be like, hey, like, are you, you know, our contact? Like, liars tell no liars. He's like, bro, what? And one of the other guards does recognize the phrase, but they have to kill them all. Like there's no saving them at that point. The gig is up. So they do that, but they see that on the head guard's arm, he had triggered a silent alarm. So they're fucked. Like at this point, they are just fucked. Turned out that a window was actually with the guards as well. So here they have a window. Here they have a speaker, because the capsule is obviously a speaker, and they're like, great, let's just get out of here. Like the alarm is blaring. We have no time. Like we got to get out of here. This is still something that Nia wrestles with. She doesn't want to do this. But the window specifically says, look, time will free them. They stay now. And she's like, all right. I mean, if that's what you're telling me, I'll listen to you. You're a window. You know what you're doing. So I'll go with that. As they're running back to the dock, they get a distress call from 51. So more things are going wrong in their race to the finish line. It turns out that 51 had been destroyed by the Watchers. When they pull up his viewfinder, they can see that he is like in shambles on the floor. Like they can just see parts of him. And they can see Vaxis on the bed with one of his arms over the edge. And Kenny, too, is also there, but they can't see if he's all right. Like, they can't see what he looks like. They can just see that he's there. So this freaks them out, as any normal parent would be freaked out at this point. And so they rush into the landing bay. And what do they see? But betrayal. Betrayal on the seed. The Watchers are actually exchanging their package with Haas guards. And Haas guards seem to have something else for the Watchers to take back to Candelaria. And they're like, yo, good doing business with you, that kind of thing. And when they show up, they're like, yo, what the hell? And of course, the Haas guards are like, look, did you really think that you were going to get away from us? And then the Watchers were like, did you really think that you could like pull one over on Candelaria like that? Like, come on. So they've been essentially double-crossed, and they decide that they're going to fight. It's an all-out, you know, laser blaster fest. Two very important things happen during this time. The window that they had brought with them is unfortunately killed in the crossfire, and Nos does get shot in the leg. And that is where Chapter 9 ends.
Chapter 10. The final chapter begins with Nostrand's leg seeping blood after having been shot by the Haas guards. Attached to the armor of one of the two dead Liars Club guards was a remote that he saw prior on the Cotillion. He smashes the control panel, which triggers the discarded cargo box, emerging in a bright blue light, a prize. She begins to fight the remaining guards, as a prize does, as they attempt to recontain her. Simultaneously, Nia is running with the containment unit, covered by the brothers and Ixie. Through an exploded door, they run towards the ship. Nostrand learns that the prize is called Nyanasha, and she accompanies them out of the chaos. The parents immediately run to their son as Siv pilots the ship out of the seed. A dozen seed fighters follow the Freckle as the artillery system on the Freckle decides to reboot. Nyanasha roots through the ship's cabinets, trying to figure out where and when she is at, after not knowing how long she was trapped for. Just as the Freckle is surrounded, all hope seems lost. Nyanasha picks up the Quintillion Speaker containment unit and figures out that inside, somehow, is Keywork energy that has been trapped. She triggers the opening mechanism before Nos can stop her, and out emerges a huge being made of pure blue Keywork energy. The Armada issues its final warning, and then Vaxus speaks his first words. Hello, Daddy and Mama. I'm here. So fuck. It's so good. It's so goddamn good. He moves towards the Quintillion speaker. Ships around them begin to explode. Gob can suddenly breathe without his mask. Vaxus is a window. We have a quote here that was picked by Blue that I would love to read now. After all the time hoping to hear their son's voice, they were happy to sit in silence. He was there. He had always been. Everything was different, yet nothing had changed. Vaxus turned to look at the Quintillion speaker, speaking to it as a friend. And out of the blue fell an elderly man in a spacesuit. His only words being, "All mother, we're free." Cyrus Amory returns. The chapter ends. Holy shit.
Bro.
I know. Isn't it fucked up? Like, I'll be honest with you. I'll be 100% honest with you real quick. If it was just Nyanasha, I'd be hyped as shit. I'd be so hyped. But now that it's fucking Cyrus Amory, like, can you imagine how the next album's gonna start? Can you imagine? It just goes, it's just a reprise of, like, Predilethal or something. Oh my god, it'd be so fucking cool. I don't know what they're gonna do with this, but musically it's gonna be so interesting. Anyway, go ahead.
So, we have Cyrus Amory and Allmother making a reappearance in some place along this arc, and he's an older man now, like an elderly man. And if he's aging as he did through the Keywork, where time is slowed down, for him to go from a middle-aged man to an elderly man in what we perceive as time,
we would have to assume that he's been searching for Mary for hundreds of years. Is that fair to say? Hundreds of years looking for Mary? That's fucking insane.
Okay, so according to the end, I'm pretty sure it was according to the end of the chapter, but it could have also been something Claudio said. Amory has been in the Keywork for 40 years, which kind of makes sense. If he was like in his 30s when he went into the Keywork to look for Mary, and it's been like 40 years, we do know that what Cyrus perceived to be 1 week was actually a year and a half, which means that if you do the math, which I have done, it is over 3,000 years since he went into the Keywork. It is exactly 3,125 years and 219 days. That's presuming that things work normally, right? That the heaven's fence time is our time. You know, it presumes a lot. But still, that's an incredible number for us to look at here.
Here's a question then. How long ago was it that Cyrus made the discovery of the stars according to, I think it's issue one? Like the first couple panels, they show a shot of Cyrus Amory, who does look a little older than what we would imagine, but I'm sure that's the three, right? How old is the Cyrus Amory in the Amory Wars is the real question for me. Because we can't really place where the Amory Wars takes place.
Right.
Like, we know the Mage Wars. Mm. We know, right, I think, what, 10, 15 years, maybe 20 years?
So the end of Year of the Black Rainbow has about 20 years gap before we get SSTB. And you're right. We do not know how long in between the Afterman and Year of the Black Rainbow is. And that is a gap that we have no clues about. I have scoured the books and scoured the texts, and we have absolutely no clue. So it could be, and we also don't even know, like, we don't know if Ryan even exists in the Afterman because he's not mentioned.
Absolutely.
We know that Valence exists because Valence is mentioned later on in Good Apollo, but we don't know what the state of the Heaven's Fence is in the Afterman because we didn't spend a lot of time on Heaven's Fence. We spent a lot of time in the Keyword, but not Heaven's Fence.
And that as well, we also don't know Nye and Asha, or how far along Nye and Asha was, or how...
No clue what she's about.
How she exists, to be completely honest, because... To our knowledge, the prize died. Like, so many of them died. It had to be regenerated by Chase. And even then, it's like, what the fuck? This could be in that between time somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah. Fuck. Absolutely. And there's definitely a lot of questions. I think it's great that a lot of connections were made in this chapter. Like, it's insane how many connections were made. Vaxis being a window, the Quintillion speakers having keywork energy, Cyrus having been trapped in the keywork and now is coming out of the embodiment of the keywork. Nye and Asha, who literally has never been mentioned before. Is she the new guardian of the prize? Was she not trapped somehow or another in, you know, is she like, because prize come from the keywork energy as well. So, like, is she, like, a special birthed one?
She's wearing the classic armor of the prize as well, the golden armor.
From SSTB, that is true.
Yes.
But again, they don't have to wear clothes at all. They occasionally wear Correct. Clothes for this or that. But it is interesting to note that armor is in SSTB, absolutely.
They wear it just for the fights. When they knew there was a fight on Apity Prime, they wore the armor.
Yes.
But we don't know if that's, you know, fucking special, like, religious armor. Armor or whatever the fuck, you know.
Yeah, lots of interesting things.
Harry. Fucking crazy.
The further we progress through this story, we end up with more questions than answers. And I just cannot wait for all of these loose ends to be tied together. And it seems like we are coming to that point, especially with chapter 10. But we do have an epilogue for this story. The five houses of the Star Supremacy believe that Nostrand and Nia have stolen their rare being that Candelaria had promised, and it was that same being that destroyed their best-equipped vessels. They will come after the pair of unheavenly creatures, as no one can hide forever in a galaxy bought and paid for by the five houses of the Star Supremacy.
It's interesting. It's it ties up the loose end that they get away, essentially, that Vaxis is able to stop these ships in order to get away, because there's no way they did it on the Freckle. There's no fucking way that the Freckle did any of that. So it's very interesting to see what's going to happen next. I find it even more interesting that we don't have any information in this book after going back and watching the music videos of the man on the planet looking off into the red sun. Do you remember that individual?
Yeah, isn't it supposed to be Cyrus? Because he's wearing the...
Is it?
Well, I'll tell you something. As somebody who analyzed the songs to make them fit into the, you know, to find out how it tied into the rest of the story, it's really interesting, and I will say that Good Apollo, both 1 and 2, also did this. There's some things that we just don't know. And there are some things that were not in the book, but are pretty explicit. So, like, Disappearing Act, right? Obviously, Disappearing Act is meant to be a conversation between Cyrus and Vaxis. And perhaps is happening while Vaxis is unconscious. We don't know exactly, but there's clearly some connection there. And after all, when Vaxis wakes up, he greets Cyrus as a friend. He knows him. He's been in communication with him somehow, some way. So clearly, there are songs that are depicting things that we don't actually see in the book, but are relevant to the book. And I think also Rise Nye and Asha is a mess of what is going on here. Is he old? Is he young? What's happening? Where is the Nye and Asha in this story? It seems like she has some connection with Vaxis in that song, but then she doesn't have any real connection with Vaxis in the book. So it's like, is this going to happen in Act 3? Is this a preview for Act 3?
I'm a firm believer that the second half of that entire album is all taking place in Maxis's mind that we don't get to see. I think all of this, I think a lot of Act 3 is going to be running back and being like, here's what was happening while Vaxis was unconscious and comatose, essentially. Because that's, I feel like that's where most of our questions are going to be answered. Is like, how, what is his experience? Because clearly he knows that things were happening to him, and he was able to sleep, and he had waking hours, and he was communicating with something somewhere. But like, he just, I feel like Ladders of Supremacy is a great example of, I think, what was happening in Vax's mind at that time. But like I said, this isn't so much a theory episode, but I'm glad these questions are being raised.
Yeah, I think that's definitely like the gist of the book, right? Like, we get tons of little tidbits here and there, these crumbs that we want to follow, that we want to nibble on, but they are over in a flash. Like, they are not... they're satisfying, but they're very short-lived. And the book felt very long, but also too short at the same time. I personally was like really following any little tidbit that I could, any news about like the story. And I personally felt completely spoiled. Like, I knew all of the tidbits that happened. I was like, okay, yeah, Nyanasha shows up. Yeah, Cyrus shows up. Like, yeah. Where's the rest of it? But I did get, like, I mean, there's so much content here. Like, obviously, it's such a long novel. It's longer than the first one. But I really felt like, dang, I want more.
Like you said, it's they give you these crumbs that just keep you coming back for more and more. And the whole story is development here. So many characters go through so many arcs. And it's just really, really enticing to keep reading because you are going on this journey. Like, reading it, I'm there with them. It's so descriptive, and it's just really immersive. And I think in tandem with the music, it's a full experience. And I kind of wish the visuals were just more abundant. I want to see more. I just...
Maybe more accurate, too. Maybe more accurate would be good because, you know, that the, one of the last panels is of the whole gang together. But here's the problem. They have with the window with them, and he had been shot by the time Nyanasha popped out, and Nyanasha's in the photo with the guard. Interesting.
Whoopsie daisy.
So he also gets shot in the chest in the art, and in the book he does get shot in the head. So there are, you know, the art isn't 100% in tandem with the story and the words themselves, but I mean, it gives you enough to go off on.
That being said, I do want to thank Jan for being here. I really do appreciate you coming on the podcast and sharing your synopses. I think you're fantastic at it. Obviously, you've been doing it for so fucking long. I also want to thank Blue for getting my synopses all together and picking out a really awesome quote and telling the story better than I think I could have written it. So I appreciate Blue for that. That being said, thanks, Devin, for just fucking being here and editing, I guess.
Well, Rob, I'll take this moment to thank you. As we have hit our 100th episode, none of this would be in existence if not for you. And personally, this podcast has given me something to look forward to and something to do and get all, what's all in here, or at least try to get what's in here. And I realize now that this is not a visual podcast, so what's in here is in my mind, out into the world, and a place where people can come and have their voices heard, and generally a community that you've created. So thank you, Rob, and I hope we can do 100 more of these.
I couldn't have done it without you, buddy. I hope we have 100 more, too. Well, this has been another episode of the All Things Coheed podcast.
I'm Devin.
I'm Jan.
And I'm a guy named Rob. Thanks for joining us.
Now I don't have to remind you because you've said the idea out loud, so.
Fuck. All right.
All right. I'm going to put the time sound bit from Window of the Waking Mind.
Oh, God.
What is that? Right there.
While we're cutting this out, by the way, Devin, remind me, I just had a great idea. Gavin once saved Nia from... Fuck.
Easy if we talked for all this time and none of it was recorded.
So I'll be honest, these notes are way better than the notes I would have taken, and that's amazing.
Hey, can you just tell Blue really quick that we thank them so much for actually carrying this episode now?
Blue, they want to say that thank you so much for carrying this episode now. No, Devin said that because he wanted to be very diminutive towards Jan, who hasn't been a guest in a while, and I think that he just wanted to be rude.
Obviously,
definitely not.
Obviously, I know that Jan is carrying their weight.
Blue's like the poster, the fucking poster. Of course,
you're making this extremely difficult to edit. That moves us right into chapter 8. The unheavenly creatures track down the cotillion, an iron structure akin to a flying moon, with Candelaria's face carved into the center of it all.
You gotta think that again, because now I can think of it as an Irish structure. It's just a fucking giant shamrock. What the fuck?
So does Candelaria have like a top hat instead of like an anak?
Oh shit. The final chapter begins with Nostrand's leg wound. Sorry. Wow. Oh my god, I'm already fucking it up. I can't read for shit. It's a lot of commas. My bad.
Don't blame Blue.
Blaming Blue. Shut up. Blue did a great job. Right, Blue? Blue did a great job. Way better than I would. I would have said, oh, visit the produce. Is that everything? Bitchin'.
The black heart.
Oh, fuck. I thought you were doing a heart. I thought you were like, great job. <I'm> like,
sorry, no.
All right, well, you can edit this in.
It's gonna be technically, this chapter was read on the boat.
Oh, that's true.
Fuck.
So we do have pronunciation.
Oh, all right. Dear Chandra and everyone else, I'm super sorry.
Wait, give me one second.
Devin's going into, I would say his mind palace, but it's his computer. He has all the everything ever. What the fuck?
I feel like he posted them on YouTube now, no?
I
yeah, because the book is out, so.
Yeah, now. I remember begging him. I'm like, I gotta know what's going on. And you're like, oh, I'm busy. We had a motherfucking boat.
And the Wi-Fi was really bad. Even if you paid for it, it was really bad.
Were you on the boat, Jan?
Yes.
Fuck.
Yeah, but I won't be on it this time. I'm sorry.
Yeah, me neither. So apparently.
We'll have to get together some other way and hang out.
Just hoping.
Give me one second. It's loading.
Kreuzschiff. Kreuzschiff. Kreuzschiff.
Pretty sure it's Kreuzschiff, but I don't know. Devin is about to tell us.
If it's like La Croix, it's Kreuzschiff.
True. Definitely a possibility.
It's such a long video, it's buffering.
Okay. We'll live.
Are you on YouTube? Okay, yeah.
It literally stopped before.
The couple were left with no other option but to knock them out. Thank the stars for the immobility.
Really, dog?
Lower your quality, bro.
He wished he could pull up even a fraction.
Now this is podcasting.
I think lowering the quality hurt the process more. Now I'm not seeing anything.
Ordinary and confounding.
Have you gained entry yet? A metallic voice sounded through the communication light by Mia's polished black tactical jumpsuit and across the never ending caramel sand of Crow Shift.
It's Crow Shift. That doesn't look like Crow. Fuck it. All right, we're just going. All right, Devin, this is where you need to edit it in because I'm going to start reading now.
I would start the whole thing over again.
No, that's what I'm saying. This is where you need to edit. Okay. This is where it's going to be clean. Crow Shift. That's the best that's ever gone.
Rob, did you like how last time I used your catchphrase?
Oh, I love it.
Makes me very well. I wasn't sure if I was stepping on your toes or something.
Absolutely. So you're allowed to use it. It's totally fine.
Cool.
Yay! Well, I have to go. We have to go to the store, but I will catch y'all later.
Yes, I'm going to recording, hang up, and start downloading this because I have to edit it by Friday.
Hell yeah. Thank you for doing it so late, guys. I really do appreciate it.
Thanks
for joining us, Jan. It was great.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Thank you guys so much for having me.
For sure. Yeah.
Anytime, I'm super happy to do it. It was so much fun, and yeah, I love talking about Coheed. I'm obsessed, so, anytime.
All right.
Good night, guys.
Bye.
Bye-bye.